Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we look at issues of war and peace, past to present, from the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror. We're joined by independent journalist David Swanson, author of War is a Lie. We'll also take a look back at the massacre at Kent State 46 years later. We're joined by Laurel Krauss of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and attorney Michael Kuzma, who recently filed a FOIA lawsuit against the FBI to investigate further possible COINTELPRO actions at Kent State from May 1970. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at issues of war and peace, past to present, from the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror. And we're going to be joined by several great guests that are going to give us insight on these issues. Later in the program, we'll be talking about the 46th anniversary of the Kent State shootings. But first, we're joined by independent journalist David Swanson. And here is Peter to introduce David to you. Peter?
David Swanson is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's director of WorldBeyondWar.org and campaign coordinator for RootsAction.org. Swanson's books include War is a Lie. He blogs at DavidSwanson.org. David, welcome.
Great to be here.
You know, David, it seems that we've evolved into a world of permanent war. The war on terror is endless. It is justified partly because of 9/11, but also because of expanded military action worldwide from U.S. and NATO and resistance to that in many places. How do we get into this mess, and how can we get out of it?
First of all, we should make a distinction between a war being justified and a war being counterproductive. Every time a top U.S. official retires, they blurt out that it's not working, that they're generating more enemies than killing, that you're never going to kill your way out of this. So you have a war on terrorism that predictably has been demonstrably increasing terrorism for years. So if you're going to get out of that, you're going to have to try something different. And trying something different does not require going outside the bounds of human nature and physical possibility and so forth. Over 90% of humanity right now is represented by governments that put radically less into war than the United States. 99% and more of people in the United States have nothing to do with participating in the military. The top killer of U.S. troops remains suicide, and there is yet to be a single reported case of PTSD from war deprivation. So the idea that this is somehow normal and natural and inevitable has to be overcome, and then we have to look at what we could do instead. And of course, by investing in disarmament and transition to peaceful industries and actual humanitarian aid and diplomacy rather than more of what created the problem in the first place, we can get out of this mess much more easily than we imagine.
David Swanson, on warisacrime.org, not long ago you had an article by Gar Smith with actually a pretty telling headline: Obama admits U.S. military policy responsible for terrorist attacks in Europe. And basically the comment here is that Obama is making a public admission that U.S. foreign policy, war policy, military actions are directly linked to the spike in terror attacks against Western targets in Europe and the U.S. Can you comment on that sentiment and how completely backward that seems to be overall?
Well, I think the comment that Gar was looking at, who writes great stuff, by the way, was President Obama saying, as we squeeze ISIS, or ISIL as he calls it, in Syria and Iraq and take away their strength and their territory, they are going to lash out in European cities and other places in the West, and this is just to be expected. Well, then why do it if it's to be expected? But I think the broader point is that taking on ISIS militarily has been strengthening ISIS and generating support for ISIS within the West and within the so-called Middle East and elsewhere in the world. And when ISIS was created, it very quickly began putting out films pleading with the United States to attack it. And President Obama's initial response was, well, we won't attack it on the ground, but we'll attack it from the air, and we'll arm and train people against it, which will help give it weapons and so forth. And this, when you had the commentators on MSNBC celebrating, hooray, Obama's not giving ISIS what it wants. It's only giving ISIS its second choice in the world of what it could have to be attacked by the United States from the air, which is predictably going to make matters worse. And then you're going to see a move to put U.S. troops on the ground, because you always escalate what's been making matters worse in order to make them even worse. And now you have so-called non-combat troops engaged in combat with ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
David Swanson, it's also the case that we see the Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Defense funding competing groups in places of the Middle East, as if it's a proxy war where we're fighting ourselves, another grand contradiction that warfare gives us.
Yeah, this is really beyond the typical mess in which you have U.S. weapons on multiple sides of a war, which really has become the norm, with the U.S. being the top weapons supplier to the world and to the Middle East and to poor countries, so that, you know, people think of these regions as inherently violent and sort of blank out any awareness of where the weapons come from, as we think of people in U.S. elementary schools as inherently violent, forgetting to pay any attention to where all these guns come from. But this is beyond that. This is troops being trained and supported by different branches of the U.S. military machine going after each other. You know, Department of so-called Defense forces fighting and killing so-called CIA forces on the ground in Syria. I mean, it's an incredible mess, and most people in the U.S. public don't seem to understand that the primary reason that it's this sort of mess is that the priority for the U.S. government is overthrowing the government of Syria, whereas the priority for the U.S. public, that has much of the U.S. public so scared it can't think straight, is destroying ISIS. And these two goals are at odds with each other. So people have to, you know, start paying a little more attention to what the U.S. government is actually interested in rather than what they're interested in and assume it must be interested in.
David Swanson, wouldn't you say that even destroying ISIS is not going to end permanent war or permanent war on terrorism, that that's just an escalating process with chaos kind of as the end result? And then even Bernie Sanders was saying that he would continue drone strikes against ISIS and they have to be destroyed. Is there anybody running a Democrat or Republican party that has a way of ending permanent war?
No, not that I have ever heard of. Congressman Kucinich was voted out by the military suppliers of a rival Democrat when two districts were merged in Ohio. There are, you know, a couple of dozen Congress members urging better policy on Saudi Arabia, where U.S. weapons with U.S. military complicity are slaughtering families in Yemen. There's nobody talking about actually moving away from endless warfare. You know, ISIS is not going to be destroyed, not by an attempt to quote-unquote destroy ISIS, which has been strengthening ISIS, and at the very best would replace ISIS with a similar group by another name. What needs to happen is to disarm ISIS, disarm the region, provide actual humanitarian aid at far less cost than what it's costing to make the United States further hated and despised in that part of the world. And that's going to take, you know, a completely different approach. You're absolutely right. Every candidate, now there are apparently two Democrats and one Republican left, but even when the fields were larger, has identical approaches as far as they've told us. They all want to, quote unquote, destroy ISIS.
Does that speak to kind of a governmental desire for permanent war? Certainly advantageous for people in the war business and the military machine, but also advantageous in terms of maintaining a mentality for a police state, protecting the people in this country, that go along with the post 9/11 police state agenda. How do you feel about opportunities for changing any of this down the road?
I think the U.S. public has shown some indications moving in a better direction. You know, I'm on this book tour with this updated second edition of my book, War is a Lie, where I look at the past 5 years of U.S. public response and lack thereof to war lies. And in some ways, we are in a much better place. And resistance to lies about chemical weapons attacks and the need to engage in a massive bombing campaign of Syria in 2013 was really stunning and encouraging. And resistance to the demand to attack Iran rather than forge a nuclear agreement with Iran last year was remarkable and encouraging. But the incredible evaporation of any capacity for rational thought that happened when these ISIS videos came out in 2014 or so of, you know, white people, Americans, being killed with knives, which is, you know, supposedly so much more frightening than nuclear weapons, that was incredibly discouraging. And so I think, yes, you have a permanent war profiteering industry in Washington with ever greater capacity to fund campaigns through what other countries call bribery and corruption, and we call campaign contributions. But I think you also have this understanding among politicians that people are scared to death of ISIS, and you cannot possibly say anything other than we will destroy ISIS. It's the only politically acceptable thing to say. And once you say it, then you can get in the same war on both sides and on the opposite side and arm ISIS, and nobody cares, and nobody's going to pay any attention as long as you've said that. So, you know, we have to get the public over this hump of, you know, irrational fear of an organization that has killed and has the capacity to kill far fewer Americans than, you know, armed toddlers or any long list of serious diseases and avoidable accidents. We've got to get beyond this incapacitation of fear.
We're speaking with independent journalist, author David Swanson. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We'll continue our conversation with David Swanson after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
He that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world. Like it's your little toy.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined right now by independent journalist and author David Swanson. You can learn more about David Swanson at davidswanson.org. Also one of the co-founders of warisacrime.org. Again, check those sites out online. David Swanson, I'd like to turn some of the attention both to historiography or history, historical analogs, and media coverage. When we're dealing with issues of war and peace and U.S. empire, these are long-standing, and certainly post-World War II, the United States is on permanent war footing. What in your mind has possibly remained the same on one hand, but changed on another, vis-a-vis, say, Vietnam and Cold War, and the way that the U.S. sort of moved its agenda in that era and how media covered it, with the way that it's gone since 9/11? Could you comment on that at some length?
Yeah, I think, you know, there were good, well-meaning liberal people who imagined that when the Soviet Union collapsed, all of the wars would collapse and we would get a peace dividend and the United States government would cease all of these endless wars that had been justified by the commie threat. And of course, that was to misread the entire operation, which was always about dominating the globe, for which communism was not actually a motivation. And so since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you've had the same war machine, but with different package of excuses. And that package of excuses has included the threat of terrorism, which is far better than communism because it can never go away. But it also has included increasingly humanitarianism, the idea of police rescue operations, philanthropic wars, wars for the good of humanity. Never mind that, you know, there's not yet been an example of one that benefited humanity. And every time they want a new one, they point to one that didn't didn't happen, you know, in Rwanda, where, by the way, nobody would ever have benefited from being bombed. We have to bomb Libya because Rwanda. And then you get to Syria. We have to bomb Syria, not because Libya. Don't look at Libya. That's a disaster. We have to bomb Syria because Rwanda. And, you know, and so this argument for humanitarian wars has picked up a sliver of U.S. public support that otherwise has dropped off.
Well, it's quite Orwellian, David Swanson, and Bill Clinton was arguing the same thing in the 1990s and surrounding Yugoslavia. Candidate George W. Bush said he wasn't going to have any of this kind of interventionism and nation building, and then, of course, 9/11 took place. So, I mean, the narrative here is quite troublesome, and your commentary about U.S. support, meaning population support for these kind of so-called humanitarian inventions, it exists. There is some support for it, although one might argue it's manufactured by corporate media and the deep state.
Well, of course it is. You know, U.S. public opinion on anything is manufactured by the corporate media, and that's beginning to slip with the growing strength of independent media and online and international media among young people on various issues, and that especially on Israel-Palestine, and that's very encouraging. If that resistance to Israeli wars becomes a broader resistance to wars, including U.S. wars. But it also has become so normalized that it's not even a question of media coverage, but of lack of media coverage. I mean, I go around on this book tour to events and ask people, raise your hand if you can name the seven countries that our current president has bragged about having bombed, and almost nobody can do it. Through these drone wars and special forces and wars without Congress and wars without the UN and wars without public debate, the idea of endless war has been so normalized that the possibility of ending it is just off the radar screen, and people avoid even knowing where the wars are happening now.
Well, David Swanson, one of the analogs I was looking at, too, is, I mean, if you go back to the 60s, there was an actual anti-war candidate. We do have anti-war candidates today, but they're third party and the corporate media ignores them entirely. So we've certainly seen in your language the normalization of the permanent warfare state and the acceptance of so-called humanitarian intervention. That seems to be sort of a mighty challenge that we all face.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, the fact that there were anti-war candidates, even in big parties, and pretended secret plan to end the war candidates in big parties during the war on Vietnam era, was a reflection of a broader change that was a result of a massive popular activist movement that was creating those situations, just as the peace movement in the early 2000s overwhelmingly won the 2006 elections with the top demand in everybody's exit poll, get out of Iraq. And then the Democrats turned around and escalated in Iraq. And Rahm Emanuel said, we're going to keep it going so we can run against it again in 2008. And people said, oh, okay, and shut down the movement and didn't continue what had been built, which was actually quite impressive and changed the culture in a significant way and was the biggest factor in 2013 in stopping that bombing of Syria, with Congress members saying, I don't want to vote for another Iraq. The badge of shame that prevented Hillary Clinton from winning a primary 8 years ago. But the memory fades, and this is why we have to keep public awareness of war lies and war disasters and resist the mythologizing of the U.S. government that is, you know, now has a multi-million-dollar campaign to celebrate the war in Vietnam. President Obama's declared the war in Korea a victory now. They're building a World War I monument of all lunacies in Washington, D.C. We have to wage this battle over history if we're going to have any ability to stop future wars.
David Swanson, we're well aware of pending environmental disasters in the world, but often we don't link the U.S. military to environmental pollution. Certainly, it's the largest polluter in the world. And a piece you wrote entitled The U.S. Just Bombed Germany, you talk about the 100,000 unexploded bombs still in Germany and how those will blow up occasionally and kill people. And, of course, there's the issue of depleted uranium. So permanent war means permanent environmental damage. Could you talk a little bit about the bombs still left in Germany?
That's a key element of the argument we make at worldbeyondwar.org for abolishing war, that it kills primarily through the diversion of funds that could be used for humanitarian aid and for environmental protection, among other things that we desperately need major funding for, and that it is the top eroder of civil liberties, the top destroyer of this, that, and the other, including the natural environment. You can drive your car around all year. You're not going to do the damage of a single hour of a military jet. The military is the third biggest polluter of U.S. waterways, the top creator of Superfund disaster sites, the top consumer of petroleum, would be ranked 30-something in a list of nations, were it a nation, in terms of petroleum consumption. I mean, it is the top threat to the natural environment, and the big environmental organizations won't touch it, and that's an enormous weakness for the environmental movement. We have to get to the point where civil liberties groups and environmental groups and other types of lobby groups for which war ought to be their top opponent is something they're willing to challenge. We have to have this sort of change, as we've seen in the area of gay and lesbian rights, where corporations are willing to take a stand. Most corporations, non-war profiteering corporations, would benefit from peace. But they're afraid, culturally, they're afraid to take a stand against war. So we have to do that.
David Swanson, you hit on something there, too, in terms of the idea of coalition building, standing together, pushing other groups, other activist groups, environmental groups, to understand the problems of rampant militarism and empire and how it impacts their own interests and their own primary concerns. You know, former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, who wrote the foreword for Censor 2016 this past year, reminds us, he was author of Second Priorities, and reminds us that regardless of whatever your first area of concern is, if your second area isn't media reform, independence of media, and fighting, you know, censorship, you're likely to gain little ground in your first area. So building this kind of coalition and awareness, particularly in your example that you just gave with environmental groups, is quite significant. As you know, the military polluter story was one of the top censored stories 4 or 5 years ago with us, that Sarah Flanders, Mickey Z, a few other people were writing about. Certainly you're writing about it. But I think you really hit on something, that there needs to be some momentum that really pushes other activist groups to work in concert around these related areas in order to create a synergy for actual change.
I totally agree. And I agree with several of those arguments, including Nicholas Johnson's, that if you want to do good, you have to work on this area. I think you can say that about the media, you can say that about election reform, you can say that about the natural environment, and so on, which points to the fact that we need a multi-issue coalition, and we will all be stronger if we have a multi-issue coalition. But in terms of media and communications reform, I find it incredibly, incredibly frustrating that if I go on CNN or MSNBC and I speak a little bit too out of line, I never hear from them again for years. And I go around the country and I speak to groups of college students, to groups of peace activists, to other assemblies of people, and I get the exact same questions, you know, the same stupid questions about World War II, about the Civil War, about Rwanda, you know, and I answer them at length and I move on to the next event, and it's the same thing all over again. If we had a communication system that worked, I could say what I have to say through television and reach all of those people at once, and many, many other people who have many, many other important things to say could say them and we could all hear them, rather than, you know, having to make our way around a country of hundreds of millions of people room by room.
Well, and here we are, David Swanson, room by room on air, right? You have a radio show. We're doing the Project Censored show. This is another version of the room by room, and we don't get access to the plutocratic megaphone, the six corporations that own 90% of the media in the United States. So literally, there needs to be grassroots movements, citizen journalists, educational efforts that are literally transforming the media system and the way that it operates. And you're likely aware, at the end of May, Ralph Nader is putting on an event called Breaking Through Power, Historic Civic Mobilization, of 4 days of, you know, really speaking truth to power and breaking through corporate and deep state blockades of power. And one of the efforts there is to try to build sort of a multilateral coalition called Voices of media outlets that are working in a sort of a consortium to bring all of us kind of together to build our own large platform that's a counter-hegemonic information block. And I think that that's something that you're also speaking to, because we also like you speak in rooms around the country, but we do lack that ability to speak to major parts of the population simultaneously, and we can't just simply expect corporate media to be reformed to allow these voices to be on, because it's counterproductive to their own profit interests.
Well, obviously that sounds wonderful, and if there's any way I can help, let me know. And of course, the work of Project Censored in highlighting the shortcomings, the glaring immoral shortcomings of the corporate media, has been tremendous. I think there's little we can do of more importance than building a better communication system. And there are encouraging trends in terms of use of the internet as well as radio shows, and in terms of people accessing international media, media from outside whichever country they happen to be in, which almost always does a better job of covering that country.
David Swanson, that's also why we want to call attention again to your work, davidswanson.org, warisacrime.org. But David Swanson, it's again so important that we are doing these things, and that, you know, you are traveling around and speaking to people about the very significant themes that you raise in your work. And again, we hope people go and look more carefully at davidswanson.org. Peter, do you have a concluding remarks for David Swanson?
Well, David, Chris Hedges and a number of people, David Talbot for one, certainly have talked about the need for social movements that are grassroots, occupied-style democracy movements like are happening in France right now. That young people really do resonate to that. And as you talk with young people, you say, okay, there's no easy answer. Voting isn't going to solve the problems in terms of choices. But at some point, people are mobilizing, and that really scares the jabezas out of the power elite and the deep state folks. I mean, they infiltrate these groups like crazy, but if people are mobilized really in mass ways, that we can perhaps see some relief down the road.
Well, no question. And we do have to overcome, as you mentioned, the idea that elections are all there is, or any significant portion of what there is, which is really a new and bizarre belief that all you can do is vote or cheer for a candidate and then nothing else, when, you know, the entire panoply of nonviolent tools is available and is what has always changed the culture. We have to change our culture in significant ways, and we have the ability to do it, but we have to get away from dumping all of our resources into elections when the system is completely broken, put some of our resources into reforming that system, and get away from the cycles of, you know, messiah expectation and then despair and disillusionment as we invest false hopes in candidates and then go through, regret over that. We have to focus on policy and nonviolent mobilization and look at how incredibly powerful it is and how much more powerful it would be if a few more of us got involved.
Building movements, not candidates in election cycles, is definitely the long-term way to go. If we look throughout our history, we know that that's how social movements tend to go, and they do happen, and they are possible. I believe one or other of various movements are taking place right now as we speak. And very quickly at the end here, I'd be remiss, of course, if I didn't at least try to tease you into some brief commentary on the current bread and circuses of the election. And, of course, Trump aside and Hillary Clinton, but even Jeremy Scahill rightfully recently dressed down Bernie Sanders' foreign policies and pro-war kind of policies. And it really is the case that if you're looking only at the two parties, things are pretty boxed in, David Swanson.
Well, yes, of course they are. At rootsaction.org, we spent a good deal of effort many months ago now trying to push Bernie Sanders towards some sort of a decent and specific foreign policy position, and really got nowhere. You can go to rootsaction.org and see the list of successes that we've been a part of. I mean, it is possible to move people through online activism, especially in combination with offline activism. But on Bernie Sanders and foreign policy, forget it. I mean, he is locked in to what, in comparison to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, is, you know, the coming of the age of Aquarius. But in comparison to a sane, sustainable foreign policy or international standards of upholding peace and the rule of law, you know, he's a crazed militarist, because this is what has become the norm in U.S. politics. And as we speak, the corporate media is pretending that primary is over and Hillary Clinton has beaten Bernie Sanders, which is just patently false. But if at some point that becomes the case, and you're looking at Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, I really don't think you can reasonably vote for either one of those people. I mean, you have to vote for another candidate outside of those choices. Look at HillaryIsANeocon.com. If you want Hillary's foreign policy, HillaryIsANeocon.com, you can't get worse.
She's racking up quite the right-wing accolades these days.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Donald Trump is talking very nonsensically and inconsistently against war and intervention because he knows Hillary's got the whole We Want More Wars group locked up. She's their candidate. And we can't continue this lesser evilism to the point where the two candidates are this disastrous. You have to break out of that and start putting your energy and your resources into something other than a broken election system and into reform at the local, state, and global levels.
And for those of you that want to learn more about how that's happening and what to do and how you can get involved, we encourage you to go to davidswanson.org. His most recent book is a second edition of War is a Lie. And at the top of the davidswanson.org website, it says, "Let's try democracy." We couldn't agree more. David Swanson, thank you so much for rejoining us on the Project Censored program. We look forward to talking to you again, and please keep up the fantastic work that you do.
You too. Thanks very much.
That was a discussion with independent journalist David Swanson. We will continue the Project Censored show with a discussion about the Kent State Massacre 46 years later. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue today's program, our theme of war and peace past to present, from the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror, with a focus on the Kent State Massacre, which passed 46 years recently. And we're joined by Laurel Krause of the Kent State Truth Tribunal. We'll also be joined by attorney Michael Kuzma. Laurel Krause is a longtime activist around the Kent State Massacre. Tragically, her sister was slain there by the Ohio National Guard. Laurel Krause is a founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and has been really seeking, as many associated with that event, seeking the truth of what happened that day. Laurel Krause also contributed and I helped co-author a chapter on the Kent State Massacre about civil rights and murder for the Censored 2013 book. And Laurel Krause, we are happy to welcome you back to the Project Censored Show.
It's an honor to be here again.
And Peter, please introduce Michael Kuzma.
Attorney Michael Kuzma is a sole practitioner in Buffalo and has long viewed the law as being a tool to bring about social, political, and economic change. For over three decades, Michael has fought to make government more open and accountable through the use of the federal and state freedom of information laws. He's litigated a number of FOIA cases and currently has lawsuits against the CIA, the FBI, and the New York State Department of Corrections. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again, both of you, for taking time with us today here, 46 years after the massacre at Kent State in Ohio. Laurel Krause, let's start with you and catch up a bit. Some folks may be out there wondering, why are we still talking about Kent State 46 years later? And of course, that was a big focus of the chapter that we did in Censored 2013 with the revelations of forensic expert Stuart Allen. Could you just briefly catch up our listeners as to what's happened and how you've taken this to the UN and beyond as sort of a footing for us?
Yes. New evidence showed up with Stuart Allen in 2010, and that's what you were referring to. He's a forensic expert. He took a tape from a window ledge of a student at Kent State University. The recording was done during the shooting, and he pulled out of it an order to fire along with some stuff that was going on 70 seconds before that order that kind of pointed to the FBI being involved in the massacre. And so that evidence showed up right as we were doing our Kent State Truth Tribunal. We were collecting testimonials from original participants and witnesses in 2010 on the 40th anniversary and throughout 2010 year. We did three tribunals. And so that evidence showed up. It was separate from our work, but it was wonderful evidence. It pulled up this order to shoot that had been denied by the government for over 40 years, and also that very concerning element where it looked like COINTELPRO and FBI were involved in instigating and firing the first shot at Kent State, per se. And so as we did the testimonials, it made sense to also work with Stuart Allen, and he was actually one of our last testimonials that we recorded in New York for the Kent State Truth Tribunal. The evidence that he found was just so compelling, we really needed to have our Department of Justice look at it, but in 2012 they refused. And so that's one of the reasons why I wrote that article with Mickey. And when they refused, the Department of Justice refuses, there's no recourse. So at the end of that year in 2012, I actually wrote to the International Criminal Court at The Hague to try to take it there. And we were rejected a few months later. It wasn't in their purview. It just wasn't appropriate for them because the U.S. isn't even a signatory at the ICC at The Hague. And then I located a phenomenal lawyer named Jamil Dakwar. He had just won a lawsuit against the CIA in the European Human Rights Court. It was for rendition and torture, and they won the court case. And so I saw that in the news the day it hit, and I called up the lawyer that won it. And he answered the phone and identified myself as Allison's sister working on Kent State Truth Tribunal. And he said, I've heard of your tribunal, which was just one of the best comments I've ever heard. Because we're just a little baby organization here, but we've got an important cause. And it goes beyond just civil rights or beyond my sister's death. It's about the right to protest in America without fear of death or harassment or even arrest, as well as accountability issues. And then the making of amends when things are wrong. None of this has happened. And so we pursued this, and we got in with Jamil Dakwar helping us out, and he suggested that we take it to the UN at the U.S. Periodic Review, which we did in 2014. And at the hearing for the U.S. Fourth Periodic Review on their human rights record over the last 5 years, two members of the committee brought up issues related to Kent State, command responsibility, what happens when deadly force is used, what are the levels of investigation, etc., and what happens when new evidence shows up 40 years later. And the Department of Defense responded the next day saying that Kent State was killing and murder. And this is the first time we heard that out of their mouths. And they also said that the statute of limitations has lapsed, but since then we have found out that if someone is protesting, if their civil rights is prevented by death, the statute of limitations never expires. So we just keep moving forward here. And Michael Kuzma's case is very important because no one's ever looked at the FOIA records. It seems as if it's pristine ground. It's never been looked into. Government's never really had to answer for any of the things that they did, and they've not allowed us a view into what they did on purpose. And so that's what we're working on, and that's where we're at right now.
Thank you for that quick overview, Laurel Krauss, to remind our listeners the significance of this and the bigger picture of it. And certainly in terms of the historical record and the significance and importance of getting the historical record right for victims of state violence. And Michael Kuzma, let's turn to you. On May 4, 2016, this year, an attorney, Dare Irwin, filed a complaint on behalf of yourself, suing the FBI under Freedom of Information Act to try to get records concerning one Terry Norman, or Terrence Norman, who was an FBI informant and former police officer. It has been shown that shots were fired from his gun at Kent State University May 4, 1970, prior to the guards shooting the students. And again, this, it's quite possible, led to a hail of gunfire coming from the guardsmen, or an order to fire, as forensic expert Stuart Allen has suggested he found on the so-called Struba tape. And this led to the deaths of Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Scheuer, William Schroeder, the wounding of nine others. This is a very serious thing. And Michael Kuzma, you've made some public statements about this. Let's hear what your thoughts are about the significance of this case now.
I learned about Terry Norman's involvement through Neil Young's website, Neil Young News. And I found it quite fascinating because I represented Leonard Peltier, Native American activist and political prisoner. When Leonard was arrested in February of 1976, he was also arrested with an individual by the name of Frank Blackhorse, who was actually not a Native American, but had been masquerading as a Native American. His name was Frank DeLuca, and he's still a free man in Western Canada. And I believe, and still believe, he was an informant. So I saw parallels between Leonard's case and this Terry Norman incident. Also, I currently represent Leslie James Pickering. He has a bookstore here in Buffalo called Burning Books. And in 2012, Leslie and the bookstore, they were both targeted by two FBI informants. So I thought this Norman episode was quite intriguing. So what I did is, in June of 2015, I submitted a FOIA request to the FBI for all records regarding Terrence Brooks Norman, also known as Terrence Norman. And I wanted records regarding his involvement in the killing of four Kent State students. So the FBI, in July of 2015, they write back and they say, you need a release from Norman in order for us to process your request. I treated that response by the FBI as a denial, and I filed an appeal with the Office of Information Policy, which is a component of the Justice Department. My appeal was subsequently denied, and I brought this lawsuit with the help of Dare Irwin, a local activist attorney. It's my hope we can pry loose some records regarding this shadowy character and find out if he was sent in by the FBI to trigger the actions that were taken by the National Guard on May 4th, 1970.
Well, Michael Kuzma, we've certainly seen problems with the Guard and the ROTC building. We have eyewitness testimony on the grounds saying that the lighting of the ROTC building was highly suspect and was possibly part of a plan of provocation. We are well aware now, after the breaking in Media Pennsylvania 1971, of the COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program of the FBI. And in part, what we're looking for here, is there any significant connection between specific COINTEL program activities, plans, discussions, whether from the Nixon administration or Governor Rhodes at the time, who was up for a primary reelection, and the actions that actually took place at Kent State? And that's something that you're looking for in these records. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, the director after Hoover denied that the FBI was involved with Norman, a letter to a member of Congress. However, Clarence Kelly acknowledged to Senator Birch Bayh that Norman was, in fact, an FBI informant. And there's been public revelation that an FBI agent by the name of Bill Chapin was actually one of Norman's handlers. In fact, Chapin asked Terrence Norman to appear at the anti-war rally in May of 1970.
That's pretty amazing. Laurel Krauss, it just seems to be, and this terminology has surfaced already, this shadowy kind of character and the potentially nefarious connections as an FBI informant, seems that Terry Norman has gone 46 years without really attracting the attention he might deserve.
And that's the way that they want it. He had to do a deposition in 1975. What happened is my parents led the lawsuit at Kent State to sue the government. We were prevented from suing the government because Ohio is a sovereign state. And so they had to win the right to sue Ohio in the first place. It was denied. It was appealed. It was denied. It was appealed, you know, on all the levels. And then it went to the United States Supreme Court in 1974. And my father's lawsuit won at the U.S. Supreme Court. So he was allowed the right to sue the governor and the Ohio guardsmen, et cetera. They could name them. So 5 years later, that's when Terry Norman's deposition happened, because we weren't allowed to get his deposition unless we were able to sue him. The deposition is a lot of, I can't remember anything, and it, kind of a smart aleck response throughout it. But what has been evident every step of the way is that the government has been acting to conceal him. They've been protecting him, and he continues with that in 2016.
Let's go back to what you said earlier, Laurel Krauss, when you said that, and again, this is in no way to minimize the terrible tragedy at Kent State 46 years ago, but you certainly alluded to this being bigger than this issue in terms of civil rights, the rights to protest, the significance of so-called Occupy movements. We're coming up on a fairly contentious two corporate party election coming up here in the fall, and the Republican convention to be held in Cleveland, Ohio, not far from Kent. One can only imagine that there will be significant kinds of protests there. And one of the reasons I know that you still persist in this is that you're really trying to call attention to the significance of our First Amendment rights to assemble and petition government for grievances.
Yes, and they are continuing to do this. The Occupy movement faced the same things that Kent State faced. The issues of Kent State go beyond civil rights, though. They go beyond in the sense of the state-sanctioned killings and targeted assassinations of people of color, protesters, young people. We have a long history of the government, police, military, covert people shooting, killing. There's no credible investigation. There's no amends made. But I do want to talk about COINTELPRO a little bit, because the COINTELPRO program that was operating during Kent State was called the New Left. That was their project name for it, and it was to target communism on campus. It wasn't about protest. It was about communism. They brought up this symbolism of communists so that they could fight the communist menace at Kent State and the infiltrators that were coming in. We don't know what other projects were involved with the New Left. We know that the COINTELPRO was going after the Black Panthers. We know that they were horrible to Martin Luther King, you know, trying to tell him to commit suicide. There was even some stuff with the KKK and COINTELPRO. But the New Left, which was all of the anti-war protesters and all the students and everyone for peace in America, they were targeted, but there's no evidence of it anywhere. I mean, can you name a New Left project for COINTELPRO? Can anyone?
Free speech movement here in California was deeply penetrated, and names have come out of FBI informants, and there's a book on it now that's quite good. And I think many people assume, and I would imagine Michael might agree with this, is that those tactics of infiltration, of agents provocateur, of hidden members of organizations who are informants to the police state, are all part of a package that's ongoing even to this day.
Correct.
I'd like to remind listeners that you are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and we are going to continue our conversation about the Kent State Massacre 46 years later with Laurel Krause and Mike Kuzma after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking right now with Laurel Krause of the Kent State Truth Tribunal and Michael Kuzma, an attorney who's recently filed a FOIA lawsuit against the FBI regarding potential COINTELPRO connections of Terry Norman at the shootings May 4, 1970. And just before the break, Laurel Krause and Peter were talking a little bit about COINTELPRO, about infiltration, and of course about the problems of how we find out about these things. Historically, we found out a lot about COINTELPRO during the Frank Church hearings in the 1970s, post-Watergate. So we do know that these things are afoot. We are, of course, still trying to learn more about these historical developments. And Michael Kuzma, that leads me to you to talk about something very important. You mentioned burning books in Buffalo, burningbooksbuffalo.com. Certainly allies of Project Censored definitely support what they do. Could you talk to our listeners? Could you tell them about the FOIA process? I think this is very significant, that it's something that isn't just some esoteric, very difficult kind of thing that regular citizens can't seem to navigate. And I know you've worked on this, and at Burning Books, they have a great FOIA section that actually is kind of a how-to to help people really understand how they can get access to documents. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, we at Burning Books, it's Leslie Pickering, his wife Teresa, and then Nate Buckley, another activist who's been targeted by the authorities. We actually have a group called the Buffalo Committee Against State Repression, and we have monthly meetings. We bring in speakers. We just had Lynn Stewart speak at the bookstore. But we've also given classes on how to use the Federal Freedom of Information Act. Most states have a comparable law. Here in New York, we have the Freedom of Information Law, or FOIL. But it's a very, very simple process, and it's an underutilized tool both by activists and journalists. But anyone can make a request. You don't need special training. You don't have to be an attorney or legal assistant. And on the Burning Books, it's burningbooksbuffalo.com, we have a FOIA section. We have sample FOIA requests and appeals, and we actually have a lawsuit. But the way the law works is you can make the request. In theory, the agency has 20 working days to respond to the request. They're supposed to either deny it or provide the sought-after information. The dominant feature of the law is disclosure, not secrecy. If an agency doesn't provide the sought-after material, you have appeal rights. And our primary focus is the FBI. So the request goes to the FBI in Winchester, Virginia. If that request is ignored or denied, you can appeal to the Office of Information Policy, which is a component of the Justice Department. In theory, once again, the agency has 20 working days to either overrule the initial denial or what have you. What happens is with both the FBI and Office of Information Policy, they usually don't meet those deadlines. The law also provides you with a court remedy. You can bring a lawsuit in one of four places where the requester resides, where he or she has a business, the District of Columbia, or where the records are located. So in the case here with Terry Norman, I'm the requester. I'm here in Buffalo, so I have a right to sue either in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of New York, or I could have brought suit in the District of Columbia. And in this case, I made the request. It was denied. My appeal was denied. We've exhausted our administrative remedies. So the case now has been assigned to Richard Arguera, who's on senior status, and the government was served with the summons and complaint, and they have 30 days to respond.
So in your experience legally, this may be a different situation, but I recall Laurel Krauss talking about the Justice Department and the investigation that Dennis Kucinich was looking into the issues of reopening investigation, and they took over a year to get back to Dennis Kucinich to tell him that they weren't going to reopen the case. And in this case, regarding a FOIA lawsuit, you're saying that they have 30 days to reply.
Yeah, typically in cases against the federal government, the government has 60 days, but under FOIA, you have a 30-day response period. So we'll get a response. They'll either admit or deny. And it's a very simple complaint. It's three pages. It just shows why the court has jurisdiction, why venue is proper here in Western New York. And then it just makes the accusations. I made a request. It was denied. I appealed. That was denied. And then I just make some claims that I have a right to prompt access to these records. And so on. One of two things I believe will happen. The government will either say, hey, Kuzma didn't have a release from Terry Norman. We can't release this material because it would be an invasion of Norman's privacy. Or they may come back and say, we'll give you public source material. There's several ways this may go. The third is what they should do is, since Norman's status as an FBI informant is out there, what they should do is process the material, and that's what I'm going to fight along with Mr. Irwin vigorously for. But this case is going to move along quite quickly. We'll get the answer. We'll file, depending on what they do, and there's going to be a local U.S. attorney assigned to the case here in Buffalo, and they'll have people from the Justice Department in D.C., and then you'll have FBI attorneys. So the Buffalo assistant U.S. attorney will pretty much take his marching orders from D.C.
Michael Kuzma, thank you for sharing that. Certainly at Project Censored, we also want to follow the case through end of May and early June and to update listeners more about what's happening, and we'll do so also online at projectcensored.org. Peter?
Michael, would you make an assumption that activist groups, environmental groups, peace groups, even locally based, were very aware of a group in Fresno, a peace activist group that was infiltrated by their sheriff's department, are often infiltrated, often watched and observed? What can they do to protect themselves from this? Can they do blanket FOIA requests to their local police?
Yeah, we've done that here in Buffalo. Buffalo's in Erie County, and it's probably widespread in California and other states, but we have these license plate readers. And here in Erie County, we have a right to use the state Freedom of Information law. We just provide our plate number, and we can get copies of every time our plate or vehicle's been captured. Now, a lot of times when we are at Burning Books for either film screenings or listening to Lynn Stewart or Jeff Haas or whoever, we notice all these police cars coming by with their license plate readers. So I just submitted my FOIL request for my plate number, so I'm anxious to see how many times my vehicle and plate was captured in front of the bookstore. But with respect to Nate Buckley, another activist who's a proprietor of Burning Books, he was actually targeted in April of 2011 for participating in an anti-war protest in front of M&T Bank, and we found out there were a lot of shady characters involved with that. They were also involved with the Occupy movement. There was one individual who was at this protest taking pictures with his so-called girlfriend, but a year or two later, this same individual ends up on the Hannity program talking about a million-person Muslim march, if I'm not mistaken. He was very sketchy, and I believe he was working with the authorities. We had a Occupy Buffalo movement, which was in front of Buffalo City Hall, which was under surveillance by the U.S. Coast Guard, of all things. This guy set up a competing Occupy movement, which brought heat on the original, if you will, Occupy Buffalo movement.
Well, Michael Kuzma, that's, again, all very relevant information. And when we look at the history of COINTELPRO, you're describing that running up through the present. And it's very important context to have moving forward. And if people want to learn more about the FOIA process, you can go to burningbooksbuffalo.com, and it's linked on their front page. Laurel Krause, I want to come back to you as we conclude this segment. Of course, the Kent State Truth Tribunal website is truthtribunal.org. Your writings are also at Mendo Coast Current. What are your concluding remarks here after the 46th anniversary of the Kent State Massacre?
May 4th, 2016 was a phenomenal event. What happened is my cousin, Jennifer Schwartz, she represented our family. All the four are represented. But the keynote was Samaria Rice, who's Tamir Rice's mother. And so there was a very large Black Lives Matter presence at the 46th at Kent State. I wasn't there, but I did watch the live cast of it, and I got to see a lot of photos. It was enthralling to see people of color all over the campus sitting together, and even Samaria Rice called for peace between the races in her talk. She also mentioned that, what is it about civil rights? I mean, our First Amendment right. If we're not allowed to protest without the police harassing us, it really doesn't exist in America. And she called for our civil rights to actually start counting. I'm with Samaria Rice. I think that it is time for us to come together, and it was wonderful to witness it.
Well, Laurel Krause, again, I can't thank you enough for your efforts to really seek truth and justice surrounding the events that tragically took the life of your sister and three other young people, again, that weren't even really involved around or near the National Guard that murdered these people. And Michael Kuzma, we certainly thank you for your tireless efforts to find out what's really going on and using FOIA and using the tools that we have as citizens to try to really uncover and make more transparent and accountable this government of the United States. So Laurel Krause and Michael Kuzma, we thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today, and we certainly will be coming back to discuss with you an update on these issues.
Thank you for having me.
And I wish everyone peace.
Thank you both kindly. We'll certainly be checking in with you soon.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain.
And that does it for the Project Censored show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today goes to Anthony Fest, our producer, also to Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us, and follow updates about Project Censored on our Facebook page at Project Censored. We'll see you next time.
criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love for the brothers in